Once men turned their thinking over to machines in the hope that this would set them free, but that only permitted other men with machines to enslave them. Hello and welcome to Tech Won't Save Us, made in partnership with The Nation magazine. I'm your host, Paris Marks, and you might be thinking, hey, this isn't a usual episode, this isn't dropping on Thursday, and you would be exactly right if you thought that. On Friday, March 8th, I did a live stream with Ed Ongwezo Jr. and Brian Merchant, people who you will be very familiar with from the podcast, where we discussed the new Dune Part 2 film, and of course, you know, the first one, made by Denis Villeneuve, and also connected the story of Dune to, you know, the larger resurgence of the Luddites that we've been experiencing over the past few years now, I guess. Because in the Dune universe, there is, you know, this kind of foundational event called the Butlerian Jihad, where people destroy the thinking machines or the intelligent machines that are taking over. And that really sets the technological foundation for this world that we see in Denis' films and, of course, read about in the books by Frank Herbert. And that occurs 10,000 years before the events of the story of Dune. So this recording might not sound as good as the usual episode because it is just, you know, what we recorded live, and then Eric, my producer, cleaned it up a little bit. But if you are into the Dune film, you might still find it interesting. So I figured it was worth kind of putting it on the podcast feed here so you can check it out. If you do just want to watch us on YouTube, you can, of course, find the link in the show notes to do that. We spend about the first half of the conversation talking about our thoughts on the film itself, you know, whether we liked it, the aspects of it that we thought were interesting and kind of connected to these larger conversations that we're having around technology today. And then we pivot into that deeper conversation about how it relates to the Luddites and how it relates to the more critical perspectives that people have on technology today. And, you know, what it means to have stories like this reflected in science fiction, even if, of course, you know, the Denis Villeneuve films don't focus so much on the Butlerian Jihad or don't really make it something that is ever something that is like constantly being referred to, but you can still feel it in the way that the world is put together. So yeah, just a quick introduction to let you know what this is, to let you know that the regular episode is still coming on Thursday. But if you're at all interested in, you know, the Dune films and our thoughts on that, feel free to give this a listen and, you know, maybe you'll enjoy it. So enjoy this conversation and I'll see you again on Thursday.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Dune 2 live stream, Time for a Butlerian Jihad, where we will be talking about, of course, Denis Villeneuve's new film, and I'm sure the previous one as well, but also connecting that with things that are happening in our own world. As that quote in the introduction there introduced you to, there is, you know, an important event in the world of Dune called the Butlerian Jihad, where they attack the thinking machines and replace it with something else. So we will get into talking about that more and how that relates to the Luddism that, I think a lot of people who will be familiar with Tech Won't Save Us and with the work of course, Adam Bryan, who will be my guest joining me in just a minute, you know, have been working on for a while. So we'll be digging into the film. We'll be giving our thoughts on that. Of course, happy for your comments. You know, we'll kind of bring some of those in as we're talking about it to pick up on that. And then, you know, about probably halfway through our conversation, we will pivot and, we won't end talking about the films, I'm sure, but to kind of bring the films into conversation with these larger tech issues that we are often talking about in our various work on the podcast or, you know, in the writing and of course, podcasting as well that Ed and Brian do. So very excited for you to be watching this. Of course, this live stream is public for everybody. It will stay up. You know, we've done live streams in the past that were just for Patreon supporters. But this one, we wanted to do for everyone, give that a shot. So hopefully you enjoy it. Feel free to, you know, share it around if you want to do that. You know, of course, this is a live stream made by Tech Won't Save Us. If you want to support the show, if you're a listener, that's great. If you're not, you can, of course, go to patreon.com/techwontsaveus, where you can, support the work that goes into making the show, this live stream, and the other things that we do. You know, if you don't have money to contribute, you can also give us some of your CHOM company holdings. We'll take those as well. But with that said, let's bring on some of our guests. Let's get to the discussion, which is what you're here for anyway. So my first guest is Ed Ongwezo Jr., of course. He's the Mahdi, you know, the Lisan al-Ghaib, the voice from another podcast who will be joining us for this incredible discussion. Ed, welcome to the live show.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to you know, chop it up about Dune and Luddism.
Absolutely.
The little jihad we want.
we love a good jihad. Have you recovered from your experience of seeing the film yet? Is it still kind of washing over you in waves of spice? Or
I've seen it 3 times and I have a few more in me. I want to see it at least one more time in 4DX. I want to have the chair rock me around when I'm on the world, you know, and maybe one more in IMAX, you know, but it's still with me. It's a really beautiful movie. Totally. And a lot of the images are just still in my head, as we'll talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. We will. I've also seen it 3 times. I'm going again on Sunday, and I'm sure I have at least probably another couple in me after that, which sounds ridiculous. Like, I totally get that this is a ridiculous thing to say, but I don't know.
We're funding Dune Messiah. You know, we're doing our part.
I'm bringing people with me who wouldn't have gone otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm making this happen, right? You know, I know you are, of course, our Kwisatz Haderach joining us today, but I am indulging in the water of life.
Right.
making sure that I am able to process this poison so I can kind of join you on that level. I don't know if that means we'll have to have a sword fight later. But you know, I don't want to have to kill you or to be killed at your blade. So I'll have to put some poison on mine and, you know,
we'll figure it out. You know, we'll make a new way.
Totally. Now, Ed's not our only guest. We have another fantastic guest who, if you are a regular listener of Tech Won't Save Us, you will be very familiar with, because I think he's been on the show more times than anyone else. You know, he needs a little more love. He hasn't been on a lot lately. So, you know, we figured we had to have him on the podcast here. Now, if Ed is our kind of our Mahdi here, I think Brian is kind of like our Gurney Halleck. You know, he's our advisor. He's our trusted mentor, our great friend. And it's such a joy to have him on the show as well. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. Should I get my guitar? I don't have like the weird stringed instrument that I could put up and sing some
sing us a little tale. Tunes,
Maybe
that'd
later.
Be fun.
I
should have prompted you on that. Made sure you had an instrument to play.
After you're off your gourd on the water of life, we can start playing some.
Perfect. Tunes. Well, great to have you both here. You know, earlier today, not just recently, Chris said that you know, he had his popcorn bucket ready to go. You know, I did not get one of the fantastic, wonderful popcorn buckets. I heard it was actually pretty hard to get the popcorn out of them. So we don't have one of those to show you, but we have plenty of discussion to go into in regards to the film. So I'd say, Brian, you saw it more recently. You know, you got out of it just the other night. What are your overall impressions to get us started on Dune Part 2? How are you feeling about it?
It's good. I'm glad to see it becoming this, you know, this phenomenon. It like very much really does have its own visual identity and its own real sort of like sense of what it's trying to achieve. I thought it was pretty effective. You know, I was so excited about the first one and like what the promise of the world and what he could do with it was. So I got so amped up about that. And it's like easier. I kind of maybe like the first one a little bit better just because I was still plugged into it, still excited about, you know, the promise of seeing the Dune universe. But I don't know. It surprised me in some ways. I think there were some choices made that I'm sure we'll talk about, both that did some interesting things with Herbert's original vision and turning some things on its head that should have been turned on its head, and some things that were left like weirdly kind of unexamined. I almost like wonder what the difference would be if the first movie were to come out today, because, you know, we're here to talk about the Butlerian Jihad, which is, it's not like Villeneuve, like, you know, just missed that and just decided, you know, but it's not mentioned by name in either of the films, but its presence is certainly there. You could, like, I was just rewatching some of the first film this morning, and you can really tell, like, it's like this very almost, it's not anti-technological, but it's very different than a lot of other space operas where everything's very kind of like minimalist and smooth, and it's not all like the blinking buttons and, you know, like circuitry that dominate a lot of other sci-fi. It's this sort of like very different kind of take on like what an alternate sort of technology without anything resembling AI might be. So I think that's interesting. And I wonder if, again, if he had started the project more recently when this was like really much in, very much more in the zeitgeist, that we would have heard, it would have been maybe made more explicit. But I mean, I don't know. There was obviously that sort of like kind of weird sort of not quite referencing of the, you know, the Israel Gaza conflict that's been pulled out when they bomb the Fremen enclave, that mm-hmm. felt like more resonant in a way that sort of the commentary on AI or the lack thereof didn't quite seem as brought to the fore. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think. I'm excited to discuss this thing. It was a hell of a movie. It does just wash over you, and you do just kind of submit to it, which is always fun.
Yeah, I think I tweeted after I first saw it that it was almost like a religious experience, like, you know, experiencing the world and everything that he was doing. And especially, you know, because religion is such a fundamental part of the story and is certainly, you know, a piece of it that is central to the adaptation that Villeneuve did in focusing so much on that element of it. And of course, he's talked a lot about the, you know, particular choices that he made in terms of what he wanted the story to focus on and kind of the pieces of it that he felt were okay to have, you know, go by the wayside to not make it, you know, too confusing, too complex for a wider audience. And of course, I think I should say, you know, if it's not clear, spoiler alert, because we will be digging into all those things. If, you know, I imagine with a stream like this, after it's been out for a week, that you know to expect that if you're a viewer, but just in case. Ed, turn to you now for your kind of, you know, your bigger thoughts on the film before we kind of start digging into the very specifics of it. You know, after you got out of one or two or three viewings of the film, how are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I really love the film. I mean, from the beginning, that ambush scene is one of my favorite sort of openers to a little sci-fi story like this. And the bodies falling to the ground and thumping.
Yes.
it was such a fun, hypnotic piece. I really like some of the moves to like compress large chunks of what would otherwise have been dialogue heavy info dumps into just like visual cues. How do you ride the worm? What's the extraction of water like, or why did they do it, or how they do it, or what's the reverence for various types of people, depending on who they are and their water. I came away with like, oh, this is actually like one really great, if you haven't, I think, read the books, but also if you read the books, but maybe, or the first one, and maybe didn't come away with the right takeaway, you know, which is Paul being, of course, something bad happening for the universe. but
what? I wasn't supposed to cheer for it.
Right. You know, I mean, some people still did, but, yeah. but also I think kind of focusing on more of the world outside of computation, right? There's, you get a vague sense of like, oh, well, you know, people have abandoned computation in the first movie because of the threat of AI thousands and thousands of years before. And I think like really zoning in on how the Fremen live life was really interesting, though I wish there was much more depiction of their actual lives, of their social lives, outside of, you know, some of the rituals that we got to see, although those were really interesting. But they're like, you know, like you talked about, from the religious framework, and highlighting the reverence they have for water, the reverence they have for one another's water. But you know, kind of showing that, you know, ways of living that are not necessarily some sort of primitivist thing just because they don't have computers and are still, and also surprise the incompetent overseers that they have to the north who don't even know about the existence of the southern half of the Fremen population. And I think like a nice little testament to like life, you know, still find there's still being other ways to live without computers. Even if, you know, not to romanticize a really harsh life in the middle of a desert where water is scarce and you have to preserve it in every shape or form it's in.
But yeah, and our vision for a future Luddite society is intensely feudal.
Yeah, right. But yeah, we're here shilling for feudalism, and then maybe you retreat to the countryside with your little siege.
Yeah.
You
know?
But I think that a lot of visions have almost no interest in depicting any like life of the in the future except computers or no computers. And if it's no computers, then it's like mm-hmm. the worst, most grueling substance based lifestyle where there's no misery, there's no joy, it's just misery. And I think, you know, I'd like that the Fremen were not just reduced to some sort of tribal, barely able to live off the land depiction, as I feel like other adaptations might have done, or other sci-fi series do as well.
Yeah. Now I feel like my, you know, as I said, I've seen it three times. For me, I feel like Denis Villeneuve is like one of those directors whose aesthetic I just absolutely love. Like, I think he makes such beautiful films that I want to go back and see them like multiple times in the cinema just to like have that experience. Like when Blade Runner 2049 came out, I saw that in cinema four or five times just because it was such a beautiful film to look at. And I feel like, you know, Dune Part 2 kind of builds on the, I don't know, the learnings that he had over the past previous films, not just like in the visual sense, but, you know, to tie that together with how to tell this story in the way he wants to tell it. You know, as you say, Ed, you know, not to always need all this dialogue in order to illustrate what he wants to show. You know, he's done interviews where he said that, you know, he basically doesn't want to, he doesn't like to do dialogue heavy stuff. He thinks film should be able to really survive kind of with the visual medium, but then also to bring in the sound in, you know, the sound effects, as you're saying, with like the thumping of, you know, kind of the bodies falling off the cliff of the Harkonnens early in the film, but then also having this great kind of score and soundtrack, you know, that Hans Zimmer and his team put together. But then on top of that, also knowing when not to use sound, like when the final battle at the end of the film between Paul and Fade Rautha is just like silent and you just hear like, you know, the blades and all that sort of stuff. Like, I think, you know, from a kind of technical level, like I think he just puts it together in such like a beautiful package. But then the story itself, I felt that, you know, the changes that he made, I thought kind of made sense for the type of film that he was trying to make. You know, I think it's interesting that he said that he felt that there were, when you go into adapting Dune, you can look at the Bene Gesserit, you can look at the Spacers Guild, you can look at the Mentats as like these different, you know, parts of the galaxy or parts of this kind of political system that's emerged that you can focus on. And he made a specific choice to focus on the Bene Gesserit and not to look so much at the Spacers Guild or at the Mentats, because he felt that it would kind of overcomplicate the story that he was trying to tell in the time he had to tell it. I also felt generally that like the cast and the acting was like quite stellar. You know, I was not sure if someone like Zendaya or Timothée Chalamet would, you know, be able to kind of get to the level that they needed to get at. But for me, I felt largely that it worked and that they were able to kind of demonstrate their roles properly or whatnot.
Like, I agree. Like, I'm in complete agreement that it's like a visually stunning film. He did, like, you know, he puts this stamp on it where it's like halfway between his own vision and sort of the what's conjured by Herbert. And that's, you know, a pretty remarkable achievement because it just never lets up. There's always something inventive or new in terms of how he's imagining these, whether it's the, you know, the Harkonnen's planet or like the chambers where they're doing the rituals. It all very much has its own visual language that's interesting. I do think that maybe he does retreat too far into sort of the eschewing of dialogue, like kind of teasing out what Ed was talking about earlier. I do feel like it's not that the Fremen are totally caricatures. He does like do some work to sort of evidence the fact that there's, you know, disagreements on how, you know, their liberation project should be carried out, but they still do wind up getting like a little bit flattened. And the one thing that I was probably most disappointed in is that in the book, like they actually, you know, they have their own, and this is an important point, I think, that was missed out. It's like they have their own plans to sort of to try to terraform Dune and to turn it into a habitable planet. And the fact that, you know, Paul comes in and he's promising the green paradise, like he gets to as this messiah figure at the end, is like a shortcut over all the work that would have to. And there's all these fundamentalist people who have been oppressed. And that's really plugs into the fact that they're, you know, these people who have been suffering for a long time and struggling under oppressors like the Harkonnens and the Emperor and then the Atreides. Like, of course they want, you know, this, of course that sounds tantalizing to a long suffering people, but they had their own, you know, plans that I think what the Liet Kynes, that figure is like really sort of missing from the second half. They, you know, they had plans for ecological transformation. So a lot, and you're right, he really focuses on the religious fundamentalist aspect and like the, and sort of like the colonialism. And, you know, I think he does that stuff really well. I was just a little disappointed. And like Paul's transformation kind of feels like a little also to me, like a little bit underdeveloped, as like he just goes for it. He kind of shuns Shani, and then he's the Messiah figure. So I do feel like there's a drawback to that, like limited to just like relying so much on visual language.
No, that's a good point, because you get that scene where they're in Siege Tabar, right? And he mentions that they have the water, and they want, but the way that he mentions it, it doesn't hint or really communicate that they had a plan to terraform Dune themselves. It makes it sound like they're hoarding the water so that when Lisan al Ghaib shows up, then together they'll terraform Dune. And not that, like, yeah, like you said, Leek Kynes, who's, you know, is Chani's parent.
Which is not a piece of the film.
Which is but also odd. Because it's like that was something they bonded over the book, and that helped cement the romance or kick it off, I think.
And not only that, but it almost kind of presents the fact that they have this big store of water as this like religious fanatical kind of irrational thing, right? Like, and it's just like, oh, it's all down there because this is this religious practice that we have.
We would never touch it because of the religious practice.
Right. No one would dare, even take a sip from this if they were dying. So
maybe Chani and her crowd like go down and take a sip every now and then to be like, we don't believe in this.
Right. I can see that.
they're religious font, we don't touch the sacred water.
that is a good point, right? That the Fremen do have these plans. They have been waging their war with Arconans for a while, and because he wants to focus on how quickly the religion can sweep them up, I think undercuts it, so that the stuff that's standing and that feels like Paul gets a grip on is like their religious lifestyles and their religious rituals. Because it's like almost every time that we get a look into their lives, it's either the religious aspect which scares Paul, or it's the religious aspect which Paul can use. You know, like when they're sitting and together and they're eating food, you know, the way in which we learn that their food has spices because Paul's just kind of like ostracized a little bit, feeling like, oh, they think I'm a false prophet. Then he has a spice vision. We learn about the water of life ritual because they think that they think that Jessica can be their next reverend mother because of the prophecy. And so that's the only way that we actually get to look at it, right? You know, like we're shown the lifestyle only in ways in which there's a religious aspect about to be manipulated or to be manipulated.
Yeah. I wonder what you made of some pieces of that. Like, you know, as I was watching it a few times, like I felt like there were pieces of it that stood out to me a bit more, you know, with each watch. And one of them was that, you know, it seems like Paul is really kind of fighting against this prophecy that is, you know, kind of presenting him as the Kwisatz Haderach and, you know, the Mahdi and all this kind of stuff, until they attack Siege Tabar. And then he feels like, okay, I just need to kind of go with this and kind of take it. And I feel like the other piece of that is Jessica, you know, once she becomes the Reverend Mother, is very clearly presented as like, okay, we need to move this forward. We need to convince everyone that this prophecy is real. Whereas before it seemed like she was a bit more kind of hesitant to take that path and kind of telling him like not to go too fast, you know, stuff like that. But it felt to me as though they were presenting it, or Denis and, you know, the screenwriters were presenting it as though it was in part like Aaliyah in her womb after waking up because of, you know, the water of life kind of Reverend Mother process was almost like egging her on to like make her do more and kind of push this prophecy further. And even when, you know, Paul sees her in a vision later, once he drinks the water of life, it's like, again, she's kind of like, I'm doing this for you. Like I'm trying to push this forward. Like, it's like that fetus has a lot of, you know, power in trying to push this whole prophecy to its end.
Yeah. I mean, like part of the reason, and I'm sure the reason he might not have communicated is because it's like much more of an explicit plot point, which is like, you know, choosing visions where Chani and the Fremen stay alive over choosing visions where like maybe he gets the revenge and stops the jihad, but loses them. Right.
Yeah.
By avoiding the South, he ends up getting much closer to Chani and much closer to the Fremen, and then gets into a position where he doesn't want to use atomics because he's scared that, you know, the radioactivity is going to kill Chani, and also wants to strike a decisive blow against the Arconans because they, under Fade Rotha, are competent and just wipe out all of the resistance in the north. And that is what throws him to the South, where his mother has been, you know, for the past few months, ginning up the myths about him, right? I get why they might not have given us insight into his head, but that also is like one of the cruxes of the book, right? You yeah. see how much Paul's just kind of like overthinking, self-doubting,
yeah,
because he can see all these alternate paths and ends up self-fulfilling some of them or the prophecies until he realizes he's like narrowed or winnowed the options and is left with a set of horrible ones and chooses the least horrible one, which is like tens of billions dead, but then still doesn't fully commit to that because he's scared of one of the inevitable milestones on that path, which is like losing Johnny, right. and kind of makes everything worse by virtue of, you know, just falling in love and like not wanting to give that up, which is good and interesting and human, but also like they don't say that, you know, we don't get that. We just kind of get like a sudden turn, right, where he takes the water of life. And I love that scene where he's just sitting in the stairs with Jessica, and you can tell he's almost kind of like resigned or bored because he sees exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But like more just out loud speaking of it, I guess, it's because it doesn't have to be spelled out, but it is helpful to kind of articulate.
See that. How he's wrestling with it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which you don't as much get. And that we should also probably point out to those who haven't read the books is one of the bigger deviations. Like in the book, he's like, yeah, I'm the Messiah. I'm like, I'm not cool. I'm not comfortable with, you know, how it's going to, but he kind of accepts this, the mantle, and it's less about, he's not really. And Johnny is just kind of like, yeah, I'm by your side. I'm for it. Yeah. And so they kind of introduce some of like the tension and the drama. I actually think it's a smart filmmaking choice because it is more compelling to see them kind of, you know, grapple with what the potential ramifications of embracing one of those paths would be. But it is interesting the way that he did it, and he didn't make it as explicit that like one of his major motivations. What that Paul's major motivations was trying to keep Johnny safe, trying to preserve that love. And it'll be even more interesting if they do Dune Messiah, because their relationship is completely different by the end of this movie than it was at the end of the book. So it'll be interesting to see how they square all that.
Probably because of that.
Since
we don't get the time skip, we don't get the years that they spent together. And then Johnny being like, oh, yeah, of course, this is a political marriage. Instead, we get like, it's right when Johnny is starting to feel love for him, you know, wearing the blue band.
Yeah.
You know, you clearly, something is about to shift when he has his vision and is like, well, I'm the Messiah now. And I've decided to embrace it. And not only embrace it, I went into like the war council and whipped up everyone into a zealous frenzy, even though I specifically told you I did not want to do that.
I know that felt pretty because it was like 20 minutes. He's like, well, now it's time. Like,
yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Yeah.
I did enjoy it though. But I would say I think I like what Denis did, where he kind of gave both Johnny and Irulan like more of a presence in the film and kind of more of a characterization than they, you know, got in the book. But, you know, where you mentioned Dune Messiah, Brian, there was a vision that Paul had in the first Dune film where he saw himself, you know, as a warrior fighting the Sardaukar, you know, in the kind of grand battle that happens at the end of the second film. And when we actually see that vision play out, it's Johnny who is actually in the armor kind of doing those similar moves as we saw in that vision. I was wondering what you made of, or if you think it's another kind of thing that he's setting up here, where in Dune Part 2, Paul also has the vision of Johnny kind of getting her face burned with the atomics. Whereas in Messiah, you know, spoiler alert, but it's Paul that happens to. I wonder if you think that he was kind of setting up another kind of reversal that he wants to do there.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know what he's going to do with that. I mean, Dune Messiah is when the books start. I mean, they immediately start getting weird. Yeah. I mean, the first Dune is a pretty weird book, but like, you know, it starts getting pretty weird. Although you could see why they would want to do that. They can like bring Jason Momoa back because he could be like this clone, but you know.
Yeah, that boy's in every book. Spoiler alert.
He goes missing halfway through the first Dune book and then he's around forever. Yeah. But
Named Duncan Idaho, you know, you just got to bring him back, right?
Yeah. When you get to Duncan, Idaho, you never want to get rid of that. Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see, because I think a lot of reviewers and a lot of folks have noted that this is it's not even just that Villeneuve sort of included more Chani. She's almost like the sort of like the moral conscience of the film and the actual main character of the film, who the audience sort of sympathizes with as Paul becomes less sympathetic and more sort of potentially genocidal, which is another thing that just kind of like that actually is kind of in the spirit of the books, because like so much happens in the last 12 pages of the 800 page Dune. It's just like he's like, oh well, do the holy war, like okay, like boom, like all the
I finished rereading it recently, I think I texted you and I was like, it ended so fast. There are a few chapters left and I was like, how are they gonna wrap this up? And I was like, oh yeah,
they do.
They do. Everything gets one sentence, like, and then the next.
Yeah,
which is to say, I think that he'll probably, Villeneuve will take more liberties even than he did with the second, with Messiah, to kind of, I bet we'll probably see more Zendaya as sort of, the moralist. Because you don't really, the weird thing about the Dune books, as like Ed has mentioned before a lot of times, is that like after it does do this weird sort of inversion on you where you think it's going to be the hero's journey of Paul. And then so you're like, you're invested in a character as you would be, or you would have been like a pulp sci-fi character of the 60s or 70s, or like of Star Wars as we know now. But then very quickly you see what's happening here. And then it just like, it doesn't give you much for six more books, five more books. It's very strange. It's meditations on sort of like long-term political developments, and you're jumping like tens of thousands of years at a time. And it's just, so now it becomes far less like obviously, a story that you could sort of convince, mainstream audience goers to just kind of buy into. So I'm really curious to see how, if it goes beyond Dune, I doubt it'll probably go beyond Dune.
Yeah, as much as I would want it. Because I really do think Dune Messiah, I get why you could end it there, but it's really, you got to end it at God Emperor, or really, it's like you got to end it at Children of Dune, but then you'd end it at Children of Dune, and then everyone's going to be like, okay, well, what happens now that the motherfucker put worms all over his body? Well,
get ready. Let me tell you.
We have the technology to do it.
I believe Villeneuve said he wants to do one more to like end Paul's arc and then stop there.
Paul's going
to
walk off into the desert, and that'll be.
I know this man, for him to be such a Dune freak and say that's the ending of Paul's arc, it's not. I know he knows that. I know that's so. I think he's lying. I think he's going to.
He's setting it up with the studio one more at a time.
Like, yeah. That's what I would do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he makes Dune 3 and it does these kind of numbers, then it's like, oh, well, okay.
If you my hand, I guess I have
going
to
back
the whole
to the
series.
Desert again. So, that's kind of Paul and the religious angle. Of course, I have to give a shout out to Stilgar, who, I love in the film, who is like, our religious fundamentalist, but also like incredibly funny as he's doing those things. But then like, as you get to the end of the film, like I think there's also kind of, a tragedy in there as well, where like he's so bought into this prophecy and to his Messiah that like, when he's watching the battle, like he's so invested in it. And when he thinks Paul is dead, like he's gone. And then when he realized Paul's won, like he loses it. And he's just so ready for the holy war. Like he can't wait for it to happen. And then when Paul says to bring the Landsrat to paradise, he's like, yes, we're doing this. Like, we're going to kill the billions of people that your vision saw. Like, I think his character is like one of my favorites in the entire film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mine as well. He's a great Arab uncle, and he's so funny. He's vibing. I love also, they do such a good job of that dime turn where the zealotry is so funny until it's not, until you really, until you see him kind of cheering when they get to take them to paradise and you're like, oh, okay, that's not, it's not funny anymore. He's gonna kill a lot of people.
It's already a 3-hour movie, so you just have to like pick your battles. You have to, but like, you want, I mean, I guess that's actually kind of maybe a backhanded compliment to the film, is that like, you're like, I would love to see him in like some other context too. I would love to see like a little bit more interiority of like what's actually going on here when he's not actually just sort of like cheering for stuff or hoping to see the prophecy come one step closer to fruition. Like what Ed said too, I wanted even more of the Fremen in like the non sort of extreme circumstances. And you do get a little bit of it. You get I do appreciate that, you know, they have harnessed this technology that is extremely advanced, and they're doing something that nobody else can. And, you know, it's certainly not condescending to them. But I just wanted to see, you know, more how he like plugs into the society other than like this kind of a fanatic rabble rouser. My biggest knock on Dune, now that the two of them have come out, is that, I mean, it is an action movie, so like you don't have to ask, but I saw it actually, like the last movie I saw before this was Oppenheimer, and I like kind of have a similar knock on Oppenheimer, which I didn't love, but you give way more latitude to something like Dune because it's science fictional, it's like fantastical, and it's like, yes, but like Oppenheimer just kind of, you know, you get like this drum beat, you get the droning score, you're like propelled through this thing, and you're given like the visual language to try to process what's happening. But Oppenheimer, I really found like was like just like a series of kind of like one-liners, like almost like a series of trailers for that like stacked together until it made a whole movie. And then like, yeah, almost like to the point where like Paul gets the vision of Zendaya and the face melting, and Oppenheimer's given the speech, and he sees after the bomb's been dropped, and you're sort of, it signifies the horror, but many of the dimensions of it are sort of left unexplored. But then like the soundtrack blares on and you're pulled on to the next scene. I think there's something to be said, and we don't necessarily, that's maybe more of like a film theory or film critic sort of discussion than what we're gonna have today, but I think that like it's a very similar mold and almost style of kind of filmmaking, where you are relying on a lot on sort of like on visual metaphor and sort of like very blunt sort of sonic cues, and you just like, and scenes almost kind of don't end and begin, they kind of just like sweep into the next one. I enjoyed Dune more because it wasn't like trying to make a comment on actual history or the context or something like that. But yeah, all that's to say that like, yeah, that Stilgar, he's played like it's a great character, great characterization, played really well, but I wonder if he does ultimately sort of transcend what he's meant to signify in the film.
That's a good point. I felt like that, especially in the middle, like there was a lot of that kind of scene, like I kind of felt things were kind of blurring together a bit. I still loved it. I was still, you know, fascinated.
Oh yeah, it's a great ride. Yeah.
Totally.
It's a reason they do it.
Another piece of this, like every time I see the Bene Gesserit and hear them talk about, you know, their plans and how they've been like going over 90 centuries to like, you know, have this kind of eugenic project where they're trying to build up this Kwisatz Haderach, this like person with, you know, the right breeding to bring about, you know, this messiah or whatever you want to call it. I always think back to like the long termists who, you know, we hear about in like modern kind of tech politics, and like, you know, how they're trying to plan out for like the million years in the future and blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. And like, they're totally into selective breeding and choosing the right embryos and the types of kids to have and all this kind of stuff to like, you know, move their genetic line forward and whatnot. And like, obviously, you know, the Bene Gesserit have been around far longer than as like a story concept than, you know, our Silicon Valley crazy people today. But yeah, it just always stands out to me. And I find them to be like a fascinating kind of group within this world, and like the role that they play in the politics of, you know, these great houses and, you know, the Imperium and all this kind of stuff.
I love that. That's funny. Like, yeah, I mean, because I think you never, and I almost wish this was a line that both Herbert and the filmmakers sort of played with a little bit more, because like it's never, it could all just be full of shit, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's always right. That, but I mean, but then again, but then it's like, oh well, they can't actually control people with their minds, and there is the voice like that. We see that working to some extent in the in the film. Like, I almost, part of me wishes that there was like more doubt cast on all of that, but that is a really funny point, because, you know, by the end of the second film, it's pretty clear what a noxious effect all this like this has, and you know, all of this is, it's very bleak. It's all like, you can, you forget how bleak like this kind of wine, especially since they don't quite make explicit, like as Ed said, like that like tens of billions of people are just like beginning to die at the end of this film. Like the universe is just is being cleansed in a holy war, in this jihad, that it's like, it's really horrific what he intended, you know, to do with this and where he intended it to go. And the, you know, the Bene Gesserit are like, well, you know, we're finding that path for like, you know, long term. And so even if like a lot of people die, it'll be okay. Yeah. So yeah, the EA thing is like a really funny, funny plug in there.
I just see Grimes in like one of those outfits, like, you know, talking about how they're planning to make sure they have the right bloodlines and like all this. Cause I can't see, like, obviously it's a women's thing. Right. And there's not so many women to point to in Silicon Valley, but like, Grimes has certainly been like Elon pilled.
I think, yeah, it's really interesting also, because it's like, now it feels like now more than then we are starting to get back to, we're getting towards like Silicon Valley beliefs that would meld well with that, right? This sort of idea that if you can create a person that lives forever or lives for a much longer time, plus has things in their brain which are about as close to computation as you can get. And I feel like a good part of the eugenics program is like, okay, well, we can't create computers or we can't create AI, but we can like use other memories to function as like the sort of parallel processing power for you. And by virtue of that, make you as close to a computer as possible while still having a flesh body. And here we have Silicon Valley being like, you know, let's do eugenics. Let's do biometric surveillance on ourselves. Let's, you know, let's try to achieve senescence, whatever the fuck it is, where you extend the telomeres at the end to make sure that cellular division doesn't eventually result in, you know, mistakes and mutations and cell death. There's this weird attempt to make an uber mensch that converges with a lot of what the Bene Gesserit have, though I think, you know, Herbert was trying to make a different point with having, you know, the Bene Gesserit and the voice and these sort of modes of control, versus where it feels like Silicon Valley is just more or less interested in doing it. One, because it came, and two, because this aligns with the vision that they have, which also aligns with the nightmare of Dune, right? This like strict caste-based genetics rule, eugenics rule, with stable, unstable political arrangements, where you have a tripod of institutions and they all hate each other in one way or another, but they're all being puppeteered by one specific secret society that is, for the good of mankind, doing eugenics. And for the good of mankind, you know, maintaining this pretty horrible system, because that's the other thing, right? They don't ever, I don't remember if the books articulate why they want the Kwisatz Haderach, other than like, this is just like a form of power that no one's ever had before, and we will be more powerful. It's like, okay, why do you want to give birth to God? You know, why do you want this?
Yeah, why? Because we can, because like all these Silicon Valley guys trying to make AGI, like why? Yeah. Because it's inevitable and we must.
Yeah.
The funny thing though about that comparison is that like the Bene Gesserit, like they have like so much more like discipline.
Yeah.
And like vision, like the Silicon Valley guys are just like, you know, like, I want to live as long as possible. I want to like, give me my survival bunker, get me to Mars. Like,
yeah. There's not, we're all little goblins, you know. Yeah. I think that's that is the big difference. There are a few of them that I think style themselves as disciplined ideologues or disciplined long-term
Thiel
thinkers.
And places like that.
You know, Thiel and his people mentors like and his inspirations is like cultivating a network. And they're not, you know, they're still petulant children, and they still also have to deal with like the fact of the matter, which is like, you know, in Dune, the societies are all more or less aligned on the same political program. Whereas here, they're still in the very early stages of a counter revolution. In the first stage, it's like, how do we convince people we don't need liberalism? You know, how do we convince people they don't need democracy, that they don't need this package of rights, you know, and And from then, you know, once we win that war, making it permanent and then going and marching on forward, right? So they're still in the very early stages and can be nipped in the bud. Yeah, unlike the Bene Gesserit, where like even by the end of the Dune series, the Bene Gesserit are kind of part of the solution, even though they've created all of this.
Yeah, even though they're scheming malevolently through the whole thing. And that, and this is probably like a good sort of segue into the Butlerian Jihad, which is sort of like the overarching theme that we want to talk about today, which is that. And the thing probably, but more than anything that I'm interested in talking with both of you about is how do we even conceive or like sort of position the Butlerian Jihad in terms of sort of this is like all the result of this other path where computers and computation and artificial intelligence and thinking machines have been banished. And we get this like totally sort of bizarre feudal society where just like, you know, galactic genocides unfurl. And it seems like also a pretty nasty situation there too. And what do we make of the fact that it has been sort of stricken like from the record, so to speak, of these films at this time, where like it's like Butlerian Jihad is not like talked about a lot or in great detail. It just like pops in throughout the books, as you both know, but it is also like foundational. It's on like page 11 of the book or whatever, page 13. It's like, here's why things are as they are. It's because of this, and it's because of that quote that you gave up front. Mm-hmm. And they're quoting from, like, it's something that everybody understands. It's something that informs everybody. So I just to hijack your podcast for a second.
We're having a collective discussion here. So
there we go. Yeah. So what do we make of the fact that A, the name and the idea is never made explicit in either of these films? And then B, like, you know, that this sort of like twisted galactic society is the result of this thing that this idea that has a lot to recommend it.
You know, I think it's an interesting choice. I think it's not entirely surprising, given, like we were saying, how Villeneuve likes to, you know, what really focus on not putting so much dialogue and just kind of showing things wherever he can. So you do see, you know, the Mantat in the first film, Thufir Hawat, kind of doing the computation, and of course the Harkonnen one as well, you know, kind of doing the mental computation, and you get that image there of like, okay, the human is the computer, what does that actually mean? But you don't get the explicit kind of detailing of why, you know, the society is like this and what led to there not being computers all around, you know, what led to, you know, this particular development of these technologies and why spice and, you know, the drugs that kind of make your brain start to act like that have become such an important substance.
It is interesting to me that he did omit that though, right? Because there is in the first movie, there's that scene like really early on. It's just like very clearly an exposition dump where he's like, he's got like an iPad and he's like, huh, like, you know, and it's like, the Fremen live on Arrakis and they control the spice, which makes interplanetary space travel possible. Like you could have just had like, I mean, and a lot of filmmakers probably would have just had like the next scene being like, this is necessary because of the Butlerian Jihad and the year blah, 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 where, and you can like a little grainy, you know, shot of robots just like right, like
Ned Ludd, like over the big hand. Yeah.
So I'm just curious. I would love to get obviously Denis Villeneuve's thoughts on this, but I wonder if he ever considered putting it into the film more explicitly, or if he would do it today, now that it's just like such a hot button, and some studio exec would probably be like, well, are you gonna like, what do you, what does this have to say about AI? Are you gonna get it?
Right.
I don't think it needs to be in there for the record. I'm just curious what you guys make of the choice.
I mean, part of me thinks it's like also because I feel like he cuts also to the bone things that don't directly go along with the plot. It's like he cut the Mentats, even though they have a role.
They're in the first one.
Yeah, they're in the first. They're in the first one.
There were scenes in the second one, but they were cut.
Yeah, right. And because it's after it's what would be the second half of the book, right? That the Atreides Mentat is working for the Harkonnens, right? And that is also a scene that's important because it's like he shows up in the final fight, right? Fade Rotha has that poison blade, tries to kill Paul through trickery, and instead Thufir dies in Paul's arms, right? But he cuts him in that whole arc because he goes in a different direction with the ending. So I don't know. I think, part of me feels like if it doesn't have a direct reference to a plot engine or a plot gear, then he gets rid of it, which is a shame because it would just also be fun to have that more explicitly excavated. I mean, yeah. I think the world is so alien enough that people, when they look at for Dune explainers or when they try to see why the world is the way that it is, come across almost in the first, or if not the first sentence, first paragraph, some explanation that ties it back to the Butlerian Jihad. But it would be nice it would be fun for the film, if only to have that be something that's a little bit more in the public consciousness and to have maybe some discussion of it.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I think it only enriches the whole thing, right? Like, it's like, oh, this is why, they have technology, but it's so different and it operates so differently. And it's sort of, engages with society so differently. You wonder, like, to the extent that, Herbert really had that, as a foundational or like sort of something that informed his thinking through it. I wonder if it's just, for him, it's a way to just kind of be free from the strictures of just like having to imagine like how technology would function in all these ways. And it's a really smart way to do that if you want to write a galactic epic about, men melding with giant toothed worms, in the desert.
So. And it's fun because it puts all these constraints on combat that then so many series afterwards copy, but don't copy the rationale or have to come up with a different one. Right? If you have a series with computers, why do you still have knives? Oh, well, maybe it's like ship to ship combat is like boarding, because if you have guns, then it will pierce the hull and you don't want to depressurize and do suicide runs, unless you do. And maybe that's a whole other thing, right? But yeah, because then, like you said, it is a smart conceit. It's one of my favorite ones, because in general, my favorite sci-fi is one where, maybe there's some fantastical elements, but I like when there's not FTL, when there's not, devices or technologies that make it almost impossible to have like duels almost. Mm-hmm. And that when those things are present in the universe, you feel it as a massive shift the way you would in our world. If there's a fucking killer drone on the battlefield, that changes things necessarily, right? Yeah. And how people approach the battle than if it's just conventional weaponry.
And it's something that people relate to. Like, even though it's not in the film, and that it's like almost a. I don't know if it's like reached meme status, but like it's around. Like you see, people are like, Butlerian Jihad when online, all like to this and that. So it's like it's in the consciousness, and it's something that people are responding to.
We do want to kill computers. I think everybody on some level wants to hurt ads, computers, algorithms.
Yeah, it is playing it. Like, even though it's not explicit in the film, it's still certainly resonating, especially in this moment right now.
I do think it's interesting that like the idea of the Butlerian Jihad, of course, these are published, the first Dune is published in the 60s. And it's both, of course, the moment when like you have this kind of growing interest in psychedelics, of course, which is why you have, spice and all this kind of stuff. But there's also the increasing use of computers and, the beginning of kind of the computerization of things that are going on in society. And there is, growing critique of what that is going to look like and what it's going to mean. I think it's interesting to look back at a story that is written so long ago to see these influences and this kind of thinking in there at such an early stage, because like we look at it now and we can say, oh yeah, we are angry with like what Silicon Valley has produced these past couple decades and kind of the impact of this highly commercialized digital revolution that, now our social media platforms are all crap and the AIs are turning out all this garbage content and like the journalism industry is like on its last legs and stuff. Whereas these kind of critiques of what these technologies are doing to society and like doing to humanity are not something that just emerges right now that just emerges in the past decade or so with like this most recent turn against what the tech industry is doing, but rather is connected to this much longer kind of history of criticism of these things or concern about what this form of technology, computers, and then what kind of builds on it is actually doing to humanity. Of course, you know, going right back to finding these influences in a book like Dune.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's all that's spot on because, yeah, I mean, Dune was published, what, 1965?
It's like mid-60s. Yeah.
Yeah. The sort of the beginning of the, you know, of the first so-called computer revolution when you're looking at like sort of IBM as being sort of one of the big, and, you know, Apple's not long down the pike, and sort of the increasing sort of the extent to which, you know, the public is aware of and or beginning to interact with computational like technologies.
And blow it up, you know.
Yeah, and an immense amount. And I think Malcolm Harris's book did a really good job of like contextualizing the fact that like a lot of this is being done in conjunction with, you know, the Department of Defense and the war machine at the time where, you know, it's all being put in service of. So like Herbert was certainly not like a lefty radical. He was his own sort of strange blend of reactionary, but you did at the same time have like the Students for a Democratic Society and people like sort of like vocally opposing, you know, certain kinds of computation, especially because they were being used to carry out to help like, you know, pinpoint targets for in the Vietnamese War. And so you can see a lot of sort of, you know, the rejection of that. And it's what's more interesting to me is the fact that we had that like that critique sort of like kind of like fell by the wayside instead of, you know, for a number, not totally, of course, there's always been good critics, but like, you know, today it feels like we have entered another cycle where there is a more widespread fervor for opposing this stuff, where there's more support for those who are resisting it. And it is interesting to talk about Dune, and I would love to, you know, drill into the filmmakers, Mike, because like, again, it seems like it's allowing this conversation to open up in some interesting ways, but the film really isn't necessarily about that. It's about the religious fundamentalism and colonialism, which also have a lot of, you know, resonance today, of course.
I need to like put in a request to see if Denis Villeneuve will do an interview with me.
I'm on the pod, Denis.
Yeah, it'd be a laugh. I'd be up for it. I guess kind of refocusing on what you're both talking about, what we're all talking about, you know, this notion of the Butlerian Jihad is, you know, this important plot point in the Dune universe that happens 10,000 years before the story that Frank Herbert is telling in the first Dune and in the books that come after. And of course, you know, his son writes a whole load of books later too, writes one specifically about the Butlerian Jihad. I think that there's like debate about how canonical, you know, his telling of the Butlerian Jihad is and how that kind of relates to what Frank Herbert himself imagined the Butlerian Jihad as being, because I know Brian Herbert, the son, introduces like a bunch of mechs and things like that. I haven't read the book, but I've read a bit about it. But anyway, you know, the notion is that, you know, these computers, you know, these technologies that we're familiar with today are reaching this point. And of course, both of you feel free to correct me or add to this, but reaching this point basically where they're basically called thinking machines in the book, where they are reaching this level where they are kind of intelligent. They're taking over. They are commanding this increasing power. You know, think of kind of what Sam Altman and people like that are talking about today when they talk about AGI and you know, the robots kind of taking over and whatnot. But essentially, you know, the society, the world kind of fights back against that, kind of defeats this vision, these technologies. Of course, there's a decline in living standards, maybe we could put it that way, as a result of what happens there. But then, of course, they develop this alternative where they start to, you know, kind of develop these human computers who are able to, like the Mentats, you know, do these calculations in their minds, or, you know, the Bene Gesserit, who have these particular kind of skills with their minds and their voice and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, the Spacing Guild that is, you know, what kind of allows all this intergalactic travel and stuff. And they're like weirdly, you know, they're like deformed as a result of using all this spice and whatnot. But you have kind of, you know, I think when we use the term technology today, we think of digital technologies, right? And we think of computers. But in a way, you could almost say that they develop a different kind of technology that is more kind of organic or biological in how they're going to try to make this world work. How would you both kind of reflect on that? Are there pieces of what I'm missing when I describe that? What would you want to add to it?
Well, I would just add to it that I think that one of the most prescient things that Herbert noted is that, like, he, in the very few sentences that are actually like explicitly sort of dedicated to explaining the Butlerian jihad in the books, mm-hmm. he does make it a point to say that, you know, as you said up front, that it's not just that, like, these quote thinking machines arose and that's what was so scary about them, but it's the fact that it permitted other men with machines to mm-hmm. enslave them. So it was
right.
It's always a matter of sort of making the power more powerful, giving them tools to exploit and immiserate others. And that's a really key, I think, distinction. And that, like, separates it from like a Skynet type vision where it's just like, oh, we unleashed the machines and now we are fighting them. It was like, it's always a matter of machinery or technologies or thinking machines, you know, tilting the balance it's interesting that then, which, like, that sort of, you know, points to a certain kind of like techno fascism where the men with the most power enslave other people. And then in the alternate, you know, society where the people have really, like, done the Butlerian jihad, rejected the machines. And then you also wind up with another weird,
nice feudal system. Yeah.
Yeah. Feudal or, you know, fascist.
Whichever way we go, there's no hope, you know, it's like, pick your poison.
Yeah. I wonder what you think about that, Ed.
There's a series I've been reading lately. It's Red Rising by Pierce Brown. And yep. in it,
I've read the first three of those.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like it because the premise is that the fascists win and they create a nightmare society and there's a revolution against them. And one weird element of it is this similar commitment to not having thinking machines present. It ends up, they've recreated a Roman Empire, and through their obsession of role-playing as Romans, this vague sense of honor that compels them to not use machines, instead slaves, human slaves, but a refusal to, like, let anything in that seems to be close to the verge of artificial or autonomous intelligence not exist. And it's, and in the series, as it goes on to the, you know, the later few books, they start to it's like this libertarian capitalist who starts introducing thinking machines or things that approximate thinking machines into the warfare and into the civil war that's been raging. It starts to shift the dynamics and how people relate to the technology. And then I think that, you know, when you have a sci-fi universe where the question is like, okay, what do you do with technology? There are, like, left and right reasons to end up at that same place where we don't want thinking machines to emerge. I think similar to, like, the romantic versus the humanist versus the materialist tech critic camps, right? That Evgeny Morozov outlined in his criticism of tech criticism, right? You can have some people, maybe like Tristan Harris's and Jason Lanner's of the world, who oppose it because they have this kind of romantic view of humanity being perverted by these machines and preventing us from doing truly human task. And then also, on the other hand, you might have objections because, like, in one way or another, they are taking away the autonomy of human being or competing with human beings in this or that task. Whereas, like, there are the deeper reasons, I think the reasons we're, you know, aligned with this and why converges or can converge with Luddism is, like, the introduction of these, of machines, of automation, of, you know, algorithmic oversight is usually done in ways that are not, and have almost nothing to do with, like, anything other than expanding production, and almost in always in ways that, you know, come at the cost of the human beings in ways that we are already uncomfortable with, right? The world that we have already at the expense of people concerns itself with seeking profits, and a world giving more armaments and more capacity to do that is just going to accelerate that process. And so then the concern is like, well, yeah, yes, it might, like, degrade the quality of creative work. Yes, it might make general day-to-day life more miserable and take away from being a human. But it also just generally makes the world worse because we have a political and economic system that makes the world worse, you know? And we can imagine a political and economic system where you integrate higher and higher levels of technology into people's lives. And it doesn't have to be some fully automated, you know, luxury space communism, but you can imagine a system where you get rid of the drudgery of work, or the drudgery of creative work, or the drudgery of physical work, right? You can imagine a world where it's used to, like, you know, to ensure that people have more leisure, have more money that they take home, or more resources that they take home. But none of that is pursued in the design, in the innovation, in the financing of these machines. And so I think that why, even though Herbert's a reactionary, that quote and some of the weird ways he gestures towards it do kind of capture the essence of an opposition to mindless automation or intentional automation and innovation at the hands of people who already have little interest in what we want in a society, right? They're interested in more profits. They're interested in more power. They're interested in more autonomy for themselves at everyone's expense. Because that is the way in which, you know, power and privilege grow. It's at everyone else's expense. And so Herbert, even though he's nuts, truly nuts, he cooked with that. He hit that on the head and understood that in whatever system it is, if you're, especially one where when people have power over one another, they use it to take away, you know, take their autonomy away or cultivate their own autonomy at the expense of others. Adding thinking machines, adding automated modes of governance, adding, you know, ways of subtly influencing people just lead to the worst possible outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. And I think that he would, I mean, I think the vibe is, and this is just like purely speculation from just having read the books and a little bit about Herbert, is just that as like fucked as the, you know, the Dune Empire in universe and galactic fiefdoms and everything is, it would have been even more fucked if things proceeded on course with, because at least this opens up all these vistas of like thought and like experimenting with spice and far flung worlds. And, you know, it's intensely creative and interesting. And it just like that you get the sense that like, that this is that all that is in reaction to like things just kind of like being drilled down to like sort of like numb, dull, like techno fascism, like, and that's kind of what needed to be blown up. Mm-hmm. And you can't count any of the, I think, his son's books as
no.
I've tried to read some of them and like, no, like, I mean, everybody, yeah, you know, he's trying their best out there, but like, it's like the wild thing is like, Herbert is just like, he, like, I know you may not like him at all. You may like hate his writing, but he's a wild like writer. Like, mm-hmm. He has a prose stylist. Like, things are just like, there's italics and like things are just splaying all over and like like words that are just sort of like smashed together. And it's like, it's fun and it can mm-hmm. be weird and dense and then his son is just kind of like, and then they got on the spaceship. Like, yeah. You know, it's just like, I'm not trusting you to explain the Balerian Jihad. Yeah.
Someone said that they have all this writing comes from like four floppy disks of Herbert's notes. And they were like, this is basically the Book of Mormon. You know, this is just fan fiction. And where you're not allowed to look at the source material whatsoever, but please trust us, it's there. Yeah, you know?
He left the ducks behind.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that, picking up on what you were saying, one of the things that obviously defines a lot of what we've received from the tech industry for a long time, but particularly the ideas that they've been trying to kind of force on us over the past, you know, decade or so, come from science fiction, right? This notion that we are going to colonize Mars and that's the first step to becoming this multiplanetary, multigalactic species. Or, you know, these wider notions of like how technology should be implemented in our societies, whether we're going to kind of live in the metaverse or kind of be doing all these other things. Like, science fiction is so key to inspiring so many of the visions, or at least justifying so many of the visions that these tech folks are trying to force on us today. And I think that goes for AI as well. Like, right, the idea that, you know, we're going to be achieving this AGI, or that it's something that we should be able to achieve. I think a lot of these ideas are science fictional, and that's part of the reason that they're pushing this on us, because they've read so many stories or you know, so many science fiction tales where there are these computers, there are these robots that are able to think like humans or act like humans. And, you know, they think that this is something that should be achieved, and they think it's something that is actually achievable. And they kind of hope that it's something that we're going to achieve soon. And so then when you read a story like Dune or see the films or whatever, and you have this, you know, this science fiction tale that essentially says, okay, you know, all these other visions that you have, here is a vision that is very different. Sure, you know, the actual world that they live in is not one that we would want to aspire to, but at least you have this kind of foundational event that kind of at least says to you, you know, you don't need to accept all of these things as, you know, inevitable, right? That all of these technologies are going to develop and they're going to do their thing, and there's nothing that you can do to stop them. I think that there's something, you know, welcome in the idea of the Butlerian jihad that says, if you are kind of collectively angry enough at these technologies and how people in particular are using these technologies, you can fight back, you can challenge them, you can say, you know, this has no place in our society, and we should think up something else in order to, you know, see what kind of our technological future is going to be, because it doesn't necessarily need to be mass computerization. Everything has a screen and an internet connectivity and voice control and all this kind of stuff that Silicon Valley has been trying to push on us for 10 or 15 years, that we can have a different vision of what technology should look like in a modern society that we live in. It doesn't have to be the one that's foisted on us by these powerful people who see particular commercial interest in it. And I think then that is kind of, you know, I guess a question for you guys, in the sense of, I feel like we're at this moment now where, you know, after this few decades of this digital revolution, where we've been having kind of the building of these algorithmic systems and kind of pushing computers out on us and making sure everything has the internet in it, that for a long time, there were, you know, even if there were problems with it, there were tangible benefits that came from it, right? But I feel like one of the things that we've been seeing over the past number of years that's just been accelerated with this push for generative AI is the continual erosion of those benefits that we are receiving, and the increase, you know, the continual increase of the drawbacks that come with it, right? You know, what we're seeing with journalism right now, and, you know, how everything is just filled with garbage AI content, and, you know, on and on and on. You know, are we reaching a point where it becomes not only possible, but necessary to have a conversation about having something like a Butlerian jihad, where we say this path, this trajectory that this industry, that these powerful people have put us on, is unacceptable, is not benefiting us, and it's time to think about something different?
So, yeah, no, I think that there is something powerful in it. And that's, again, we're getting back to what we were talking about earlier, how we just wish it was like a little bit more explicit in this film. So it could be a little bit more of a touchstone for folks who are having these anxieties right now. And it was just like, because, yeah, no, I do think that's a powerful thing, that it's like, even if, you know, these, you know, even if a lot of what happens in this universe is not great, here's this rich alternate world in which this vision that isn't being shoved down our throats does not succeed. Like, this is a different, it's a different world with a different set of values, and completely radically reimagined. And you can imagine sort of, you know, you maybe up to the giant worm human hybrid being, you know, a different
pass on that piece of it. Yeah.
And that's, I think, also,
and, you know, the holy war where billions of people are killed,
but besides that too.
Yeah.
but I think, I mean, I do think that it's useful to say that, you know, to think that, you know, we're doing a kind of a lot with a little of actual text here to go on. Yeah. But it does seem that, you know, one point that you could extrapolate is that, You know these kinds of wild sort of Bene Gesserit generational sort of searching for a chosen one, or using mind powers unlocked by a spice. You know, it, that seems radical too. But imagine that it must have gotten to a certain point 10,000 years ago before this came, where there needed to be not just sort of, it's not called like the Butlerian like resistance, it's called the Butlerian jihad, where we know the role that a jihad plays in the Dune universe. We know how all consuming it is and how bad things had to get in order to see one. So I think that there may be like sort of a word of warning here that if there isn't, you know, any sort of course correction or actual or resistance or rejection of certain technologies, then yeah, like the equivalent of sort of blowing up server farms or whatever is something, you know, that could well take place. I certainly don't think Herbert is like endorsing the Butlerian jihad as like a means of action. I do think that he's like putting it on the table as something that could potentially happen in our universe if, you know, something like Silicon Valley continues to accrue power in the way that it kind of has.
Yeah. And just to be clear from what you're saying, in Malcolm Harris's book, Palo Alto, he explains that history of how people used to bomb computer centers, you know, back in, I think it was like the 60s or the 70s or something. Mm-hmm.
You know, they bombed the HP CEO's house. They bombed the CEO of HP. They just firebombed. Like it was a lot more dangerous back then. So
they had the names and addresses of executives circling around on the list. Yeah.
And I think we kind of forget that piece of the history today, right? When we think about, we can't push back on these tech companies. It's like at a much earlier stage, like people were much more aggressive on these things. And I think what you say is really important, where it's like, you know, if we're not going to start reining things in now, we're going to reach a point where it's going to be like burn this whole thing down and start over because it's just completely unacceptable. Ed, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we can definitely, you know, one thing I think is there need to be more defenses of sabotage. And I think we're getting there, you know, how to blow up a pipeline and in defense of looting. By Andreas Baum and Vicky Osterweil, respectively, are both really great texts that kind of just are trying to interrogate this idea people have that clearly creates a moral aversion for them with the destruction of property and viewing looting in a specific and different arguments that come up. Looting as, you know, having racial animus around it, and then blowing a pipeline as being terrorism. And counterproductive and irresponsible and so on and so forth, right? And thinking about ways in which, you know, you can kind of invert it and give people the tools necessary and the arguments necessary to actually defend, not just, you know, I think the tendency is to do now, which is like if someone does it, be like, well, I'm not condoning it, but you can understand why someone's doing it, to shift that, you know, to shift from that to being like, well, yeah, we should be doing that. You know, people should be doing sabotage, whether it's in their workplace or of a place that they think is causing harm. Because, you know, one of the things I've had a huge problem with is for years and years and years, especially liberal commentators like to say that Facebook is the greatest threat to our civilization or to our informational civilization. And then what's the solution? You know, call your congressman or something, you know, if this company, which has
an oversight board,
right. You know, if it's the greatest threat, then why are we not attacking the physical infrastructure, right? No one's advocating for what is, I think, the hard line, which is like, you know, hurting anyone. But we are advocating for disruption of its functions to impose that as a cost. And to that in of itself is a radicalizing act that galvanizes other groups of solidarity and experimentation and further direct action, right?
Yeah. I think it's interesting to see that evolution, especially with the self-driving cars going mm-hmm. back to like the summer mm-hmm. last year, where first it was coning and we're shutting them down. And even that, by just like placing gently placing an orange traffic cone on the hood of a Waymo car, was enough to get Google and GM to say like, oh, we're going to find who's responsible and, you know, file criminal vandalism charges for gently placing a cone. To then someone took a sledgehammer to them. And then a few weeks ago, somebody threw a firework inside one and threw it underneath. We're seeing like the boundaries of what's possible sort of, evolving. And, you know, in the face of, I think it's important to note, like, utter intransigence from the tech companies themselves who are seeing things like this. And then, well, and kind of unrelated, but there was also the, did you see there's like a German group called the Volcano Group that,
yes,
they cut the wires to the Tesla Gigafactory, which is, again,
it's been closed, like, for a few days now.
Yeah. Yep. So there's actual, and it's actual direct action. Mm-hmm. And both of these cases are, you know, examples where, like, you can be pretty sure that nobody's going to get hurt. You have a driverless car that's, like, holding up traffic and pissing people off, and then you have, you know, some cables on the ground. So it is a moment, combined with everything we were talking about earlier with the, you know, this AI, which I think is the generative AI is a unique technology in that its social benefits is so minimal compared to, like, what you could, at least, you know, Google could, like, rightfully say, like, hey, we're giving you access to the world's information. Like, this is a new thing. You couldn't just, like, Google a fact and, like, find the like that. That's new. Now they're saying, oh, well, we can kind of, like, mash up some art that we vacuumed up into our database and spit out a new picture for you. Like, okay, great. Yeah, what does that do for me? You know, like, okay, this can write a marketing email. That doesn't mean anything to most people. And yet it is this incredibly disruptive force. So all of this anger is, and I think I wrote about this on my newsletter, and it was, I think that's all getting sort of pulled up into these more tangible targets we have now, like self-driving cars, and then now, like, the Gigafactory. You know, it's hard to, you know, attack a server farm because there's a lot of security and that takes, like, coordination. And but if you're mad at big tech in a sort of a more generalized level, and then here comes, like, a Waymo car, like, it's gonna run over your dog, then yeah, you know, that's a target right there. I think things are absolutely getting interesting, and it's an interesting just like the Butlerian jihad. It's not, again, it's not in the text of the film. It's not, like, there, but it's ever online. It's like, yeah, it's like become, people don't even necessarily know that it's related to Dune. Yeah. I've seen these people online going, like, I thought this had something to do with, like, Judith Butler.
Yeah. See that many times. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get her in Dorset. That'll be a nice one.
There we go. Yeah. Close the loop. But yeah, I do think it's interesting, though, to think about how these things are escalating. And I wonder when it reaches the point when we actually see someone, like, attack a data center or something, right? Because it's not just with the data centers, it's not just like they're out there and we're not thinking about them. It's like there are a lot of communities, a growing number of communities that are very angry about the location of these data centers near their communities because of the energy use, because of the water use. You know, it depends on the particular area in which those are worse. But, like, you know, I spoke to a researcher in the UK who's from Chile, who told me about, you know, how a community in Santiago in Chile basically stopped one of these Google data centers from being built because of the amount of water that it was going to require. And they were worried, because the company was so, you know, unwilling to share information, that it was going to use so much water that it was going to force them back to using water trucks instead of having, like, water piped into their homes, right? Like, this is the real kind of level of things that people in some parts of the world are facing when it comes to these rollout of these technologies and what is required to make these technologies work that can, you know, be hidden from view, but that a lot of people are increasingly waking up to and are saying, like, this is completely unacceptable. This has gone too far, especially as I was saying, the benefits of this supposed revolution, internet revolution, whatever you want to call it, seem to be degrading day by day because of, you know, one, the AI push, but on the other hand, like, just the increased pressures of commercialization and of profit making that are eroding even, like, the benefits of the Google search engine and what we used to like about social media and stuff like that. Like, none of it can last anymore, because everything needs to be commercialized to the maximum degree possible, as these companies seem to be kind of hitting a ceiling with what they can roll out and the money that they can make. And it does seem that we're at this point where we're kind of at a breaking point.
Yeah, it does. And for all of those reasons too, I think, you know, it coal plants are that were planned, yeah, to shutter are being their lifespans are being extended to power these generative AI firms. And it, you know, I spent a lot of time arguing in my column last year that's one big reason that we had to see this concerted effort to generate just unrelenting hype about like what this was going to do, even if it veered into apocalyptic territory, just because like they had to make the case that this thing was so powerful that we all had to sort of like buy into it now, because you had to get, you know, you had to get like the horse in front of the wagon, because if you didn't, then people are saying, well, wait, what now? Like, what now? Why are we like keeping, why are we, you know, diverting our water supplies and like not decommissioning our coal plants? Like, why are we doing this? And it becomes more of a moral issue. And I do think that that's like that this, again, this film comes at this interesting point where we do have, there's this nexus where it's like being recognized as a moral issue, not like, what does this technology mean? But like, should we be doing this? Should we be going down this road at all? Like, should we be countenancing the generative AI as like an endeavor, as what Silicon Valley, you know, forecast as its vision for all of it? It is kind of a point where there we can sort of view it almost more as a binary, and we have seen some instances where people have been successful in taking the negative, right? We saw the writer's strike say, you know, last year around this, and we saw them say no, and it's not like they banished generative AI from the face of the earth or from their purview, but they did oppose it and win. So it's, I think there's a space that's open now, and there's more people than ever who are interested in talking about this, interested in taking action. Since leaving the column, I've been talking to
some RIP column.
Yeah. RIP, critical tech column. I've been talking to folks with the, California Labor Federation, Freelance Solidarity. People are like ready to get boots on the ground. And, you know, I'll, you know, Ed can be the George Meller of the Luddites with the actual hammer leading the, maybe I'll be the Gravener Henson trying to rally in the pub rooms, but no, maybe I'll have the hammer too. I don't know.
You do have a hammer also. So
I, think
can,
I think you can see the hammer.
Yeah, like, I can see it.
There was a point last year, I was like, I've just been driving around with like this sledgehammer in the back. Yeah,
see something, do something. You see a driver of this car?
It was funny in Oakland after we did some Luddite tribute. Yeah. We put Tech on trial, and Paris and I went out to get a drink afterwards. And I was just carrying around the hammer around Oakland just because I didn't want to leave it at the bar.
Right.
But so we were like, are you open? Yeah. He's like, you're going to have to leave your hammer at the door, though.
When we were in New York, I had to pick up the hammer to bring to the event. And I was like coming down the elevator with the hammer, and there was this like old couple next to me, and they were like, what's that hammer for? I was like, it's okay, we're just smashing technology. They were like, okay. Right.
yeah. So
I love it. You know, I think one thing that kind of stood out to me from the past year is when Eliza Yudkowsky wrote that column in Time magazine last year talking about dropping bombs or even nukes on data centers. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, like I would kind of be up for that, but for such different reasons.
Yeah. Like,
I'm not concerned about the AGI, but I'm still up for bombing the data centers and getting rid of them. Guys, this has been a fantastic chat. To end it off, you know, any final comments, and who's your favorite standout character in the film? Any final comments on the Butlerian Jihad, the Luddite stuff, but also give me your fave.
I mean, Fade Rotha was just amazing. You know, Austin Butler, yeah. I've heard him slip into the Elvis voice a few times.
Yeah.
But it's okay. You know,
there's a little bit of that in there. Yeah. Mixed between Stellan and Elvis.
I love how much of a fucking freak he was. Especially, I love the cut away from the room where she gives him the test was so funny to me, because they're like, can we control him? We can control him with humiliation and pain. And she's like, no, actually, he likes those things.
Yeah.
We cannot do that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Rebecca Ferguson. I think she becomes that Reverend Mother pretty like I feel like that every few years, Hollywood kind of has a round table and they decide, they're like, who's going to be our lady of sci-fi? And like, yeah. For a while it was Scarlett Johansson. She was in Lucy and Under the Skin.
And Her.
Great film. Mm-hmm. And Her, yeah.
Besides Always Saldana a bit for a while.
Yeah, and now it's very much, I feel like, Rebecca Ferguson between this and Silo. And
I haven't watched that yet. I need to do that.
The book's really good too. You should check out the book.
I have a signed copy of one of his books. I don't know if it's that one, but
Yeah, I was digging it. Like it starts out a little stronger than it goes on to be because it's a full, but it's compelling. It's a swing. The one thing I do appreciate about Apple is it's like doing all these sci-fi swings, and Rebecca Ferguson's in like half of them. So that's my shout. And yeah, just another sort of underlining of the fact that it's very interesting and very notable. And I'm glad we're having this conversation at this moment, because whether or not the Butlerian Jihad is in the movie, like people have just gone to lengths to extract it from the movie, from the text, made it a meme because it's in the air. It's just yet another reflection of sort of the increasing warranted, justified hostility that people are feeling towards, what big tech and these generative AI companies in particular at this moment are doing right now. So yeah, interesting times for sure.
Totally. Definitely interesting times. I feel like it's so hard to choose a favorite because there are so many great performances and like fascinating characters. I feel like I already gave a shout out to Stilgar earlier, so I'll leave him off because I do love him very much. I still love Stellan Skarsgård as the Baron. I think that's like such a disgusting and fascinating performance. And he's changed quite a bit from the book. He's not like the kind of pedophile that you have there so much. You know, he still kisses Fade Rautha at one point. They have an interesting relationship there. But yeah, I've just been watching the interviews with Stellan Skarsgård as well. Like I just love him. I think he's so fantastic.
I love him in the he's not in the next one. You'll love him in Children of Doom.
Oh, he's bad. Okay. Good to know. I've read the first two. I haven't read past that. So yeah. Well, Brian, Ed, really fantastic to speak with you about all of this, to dig into it, to talk about the film that I'm kind of in love with and we'll see another few times. And to talk about how it relates to the things that are going on right now. Of course, Ed Onwuesu Jr. is a tech writer and co-host of the This Machine Kills podcast that you can check out. Brian Merchant, of course, also a tech journalist and writes a newsletter called Blood in the Machine, is also the author of the book of the same name, which is The History of the Luddites, that you will want to certainly check out. It's over here on my shelf. I should have taken it off so I could like hold it up and show people. Fantastic book, Blood in the Machine. Highly recommend. And of course, if you're not a listener of Tech Won't Save Us already, make sure to go to your podcast platform of choice. Check it out, where we have critical conversations about technology all the time. You can, of course, also support the show on Patreon if you're not already a supporter. We have a bunch of premium episodes digging into Elon Musk and his kind of impact on the world. I'll also send you some stickers if you support the show. So that's always a cool thing. And just to kind of recap here, I've drank about half of my water of life. I'm really kind of feeling the visions flowing through me now. I've been converting this poison. So Ed, we might have to get ready for that battle sometime.
Oh yeah. Let's do our little fight.
Yeah. Right. Awesome. Well, I'll be looking forward to that.
Bring the hammer.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. But thanks again, guys. Thanks to everyone for watching. This has been fantastic, and we'll have to do another one sometime.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This was great.
Anytime.